This is the place, and this is the time. Here and now, the mystery awaits to break into our experience, to change our minds, to change our lives, to change our ways, to help us see the world and the whole of life in a new light. This is the place. This is the time. Here and now, let us praise the mystery by joining together in song. At the center of our service and at the center of our lives, we take this time to light candles of memory, candles of hope, or because we feel troubled, blessed, conflicted, or simply because we'd like to add a little light to the world. Join me, if you will, in an attitude of prayer. Mystery of many names, mystery beyond all naming. We contemplate this week and our hearts are heavy. We are frightened, worried, anxious, uneasy. We find ourselves echoing the words of the character played by Sir Laurence Olivier in Marathon Man, "Is it safe?" That maddening question was asked over and over again to Dustin Hoffman's character as he was strapped in a dental chair and tortured with a high-speed drill. Is it safe? Is it safe? It used to be said that there was safety in numbers, but the Holocaust, the gulags, Pol Pot's killing fields, and the bucolic rolling hills of southern Virginia Tech seemed to nullify such naive notions. It is not safe. It never will be safe. And we best get used to it. In the late 1940s, I was taught a prayer that I said every night as I kneeled beside my bed. Now I lay me down to sleep, I pray the Lord my soul to keep. And if I should die before I wake, I pray the Lord my soul to take. I used to think that that was a terrible thing to teach a child to say right before turning out the lights. But now, I'm not so sure. Perhaps there's some wisdom in that prayer. Perhaps it let me in on the adult secret that I hadn't always been here. There'd come a time when I would be here no more. Perhaps, just perhaps, that was a good thing for me to know at the age of 4. This past week's massacre holds for me a bright and shining moment. Holocaust survivor Dr. Lubescu stood in the doorway to his classroom, room 204, Norris Hall, and was shot 5 times as he yelled for his students to escape out the windows. The image of this man who had survived the worst that Nazi Germany could throw at him, the image of this man staving off death as his young pupils jumped to their freedom, this is the image that I wish to hold in my heart when I think of Virginia Tech. There was a massacre that day, but there was also an active demonstration of the power of love. Frank Zappa and the Mothers of Invention once recorded a song entitled "It Can't Happen Here." It was a parody and ironic because Zappa, whose favorite vegetable was tobacco, knew anything can happen anywhere, and more precisely, whenever something happens to one of us, it happens to all of us. May we in the coming weeks not demonize the young Korean man who perpetrated these acts of violence. All efforts to scapegoat and marginalize him now are beside the point. He is one of us. Whatever his crimes, we ourselves are capable of the same. To deny this is to invite disaster upon ourselves. Yes, it's good to remember the noble acts, those done by the better angels of our natures, but we must never forget that other angels attend us, and those lesser angels of our natures will, if ignored, act out when we least expect it. We pray this in the name of everything that is holy, and that is precisely everything. Amen. Got one reading this morning. It's from Martin Niemöller. First they came for the communists, but I was not a communist, so I did not speak out. Then they came for the socialists and the trade unionists, but I was neither, so I did not speak out. Then they came for the Jews, but I was not a Jew, so I did not speak out. Then they came for me, and there was no one left to speak out for me. Fear can make people do odd things. And it's fear generated by the events of 9/11, the events following that, which have created an atmosphere of terror in this country. In this atmosphere, the present regime has co-opted the rights of people. It's going about the business of greedy business in the name of our country, and I don't much like that. I'm not alone in that dislike. In an article copyrighted in the New York Times in 2004, Anthony Lewis has this to say, quote, fear of terrorism, a quite understandable fear after 9/11, has led to harsh departures from normal legal practice at home. Aliens swept off the street by the Justice Department as possible terrorists after 9/11 were subjected to physical abuse and humiliation by prison guards. Then Attorney General John Ashcroft did not apologize, a posture that sent a message. Lewis continues, inside the United States, the most radical departure from law, as we have known it, is President Bush's claim that he can designate any American citizen as an enemy combatant, thereupon detain that person in solitary confinement indefinitely without charges, without a trial, and without right to counsel. There was a stunning moment in President Bush's 2003 State of the Union address when he said that more than 3,000 suspected terrorists, quote, have been arrested in many countries. Many others have met a different fate. Let's put it this way, they're no longer a problem for the United States, end quote. In all these matters, there is a pervasive attitude that to follow the law is to be weak in the face of terrorism. But commitment to law is not weakness. It has been the great strength of the United States from the beginning. Our leaders depart from that commitment at their peril and ours for a reason that Justice Louis D. Brandeis expressed 75 years ago. Our government is the potent, the omnipresent teacher for ill or good. It teaches the whole people by his example. Crime is contagious. If the government becomes lawbreakers, it breeds contempt for the law. It invites every person to become a law unto themselves. Senator Edward Kennedy, just this past month, on the 29th of March, at an event organized by the Alliance for Justice, said, quote, at the heart of many of the serious challenges we face is the Bush administration's lack of respect for the rule of law. What I present to you today is not meant to convince you that political right is wrong or that the political left is correct. All I really want to do is pull back from this lawless situation that we find ourselves in, ruminate upon what others have done in similar situations. And within that rumination, I hope that we can find the room to understand what is happening to us as a people and a nation. The murder rate in big cities has gone up constantly since the inception of the war in Iraq. And need I mention the events at Virginia Tech this past Monday? Perhaps if we can get a perspective upon what is happening, then we can more readily go out and act and stop simply reacting. If you think there's no chance that you are in danger from this government and there's no way in hell that you would ever be considered an enemy combatant, then I'm afraid you're in the gravest danger. The trouble starts with a state that wants all the attention. The state is jealous of life, and as an institution, just like a corporation, it, the government, the state, really has no life. As the former Yale chaplain William Sloan Coffin remarked, to die for one's own country is on the same level as dying for the post office. During the initial stages of the Iraqi war, the New York Times had a picture of an Iraqi man who was carrying the wrapped body of a six-month-old child into a cemetery. The article said the grave diggers had all run away because of the bombing. Down from where the man dug, there was another man digging. The black flies were everywhere. They covered the ground before he thrust the shovel into the ground. He's standing among the ruins of his brother, who died in the first Gulf War. There isn't much there. In a hefty garbage bag hanging on an adjacent headstone, there are the remains of his sister-in-law and her two daughters. Remains is an apt word here. I turn the page quickly because I can read no more of this. Staring back at me is a young Iraqi who has bandaged leg stumps holding him up in his bed. I can see the Broadway billboards now, collateral damage does Porgy and Bess. This from my former teacher and head of the philosophy department at the University of Florida from 1965 to 1971. Authoritarianism is the long shadow which the human species has dragged after itself during its historical pilgrimage toward the light. No one knows whether during our immensely long trek we have made any lasting advance in the direction of that light. But everyone knows that the only way of having a direction in which to advance is by facing toward the light and intending that direction. Now let's consider the long shadows of political leadership and what those shadows have covered up and where eventually we will end up if so led. The 20th century theologian Karl Barth said this about Pontius Pilate. He was bound to act according to strict law, but does not do so, and lets himself be determined by political considerations. Pontius Pilate, a man who essentially disappears from history, evaporating like the water that dripped on the floor after he washed his hands of the whole ordeal, broke a covenant that existed between himself and Rome. As an administrator and agent of the Roman Empire, Pilate was expected to carry out the Roman law. But Pontius Pilate did what was expedient. Expedient, politic, though perhaps unprincipled. Karl Barth gives me the title to my sermon here. In the person of Pilate, the state withdraws from the bias of its own existence, the basis of its own existence. It becomes a den of robbers, a gangster state, an ordering of an irresponsible clique. And what does it mean that Pilate broke the Roman covenant? What does it mean that he would not uphold the Roman law? Covenant is relationship. Relationship presumes personhood. As long as Pilate acts according to what he knows to be Roman law, he occupies the personhood of his life. Yet when he breaks covenant, even the pagan covenant of Roman law, he breaks with relationship, personhood, and becomes a loose cannon. What does Pilate do? He does what politicians more or less always have done and what they always will do. What has always belonged to the actual achievement of politics in all times. He attempts to rescue and maintain order in Jerusalem and thereby at the same time to preserve his own position of power by surrendering the clear law for the protection of which he was actually installed. It's a remarkable contradiction. What I'm saying is this. In a postmodern world when we have lost the ability of reason to explain the universe and God, when the meta-narrative seems to have lost its foothold, where ambiguity rains down upon us until we are soaked in the showers of impotency, perhaps it's time to rejoice. Rejoice that we live in a time when the state is a negative format. Rejoice that we live in a time when we can understand the developing scenarios. Rejoice that we live in a time when we can see in the dark room of our souls that the polarities have been reversed. Everything we know to be light is seen now by the state as darkness, and everything that shines forth from the state is nothing but bright midnight. Are you confused about what to believe, what to act upon, what to do next? Take a look at this country under its present regime, and go ye therefore in the opposite direction. Yet unfortunately, the imagination of this people and this country is produced, coddled, and prodded by sound bites and wars that look like Super Bowls. Smart bombs and shock and awe are reality television at its ultimate destination. We sit and eat popcorn as others die. As Rome degenerated and eventually fell, the emperors gave the people what? Bread and circuses. Bread to fill their stomachs and circuses to amuse their spirits. We watch as the covenant is being broken and we cheer as the pieces fall down upon us. We fail to see that those maimed, starved, and blown up are, in fact, ourselves. In the immortal and unforgettable words of the cartoon character Pogo, we have met the enemy and he is us. The reason we are the enemy is we are out of covenant and communion even with ourselves. As Thomas Paine expressed it, a long habit of not thinking a thing wrong gives in to a superficial appearance of its being right and raises at first a formidable outcry in defense of custom. But the tumult will subside. Time makes more converts than reason. As time goes by and more original wrongs slide in the category of right, we begin to be able to witness horror and turn away with a shrug. How long will it be before Virginia Tech becomes a documentary, is given an award, and we forget? But even though these meteorites of injustice do not annihilate us, they do alienate us. Susan Sontag recently wrote in The Nation, "It will always be unpopular, it will always be deemed unpatriotic to say that the lives of the members of the other tribe are as valuable as the lives of one's own tribe." If freedom cannot be found in the gangster state, then there's even less hope for the dominant culture's churches. Since the time of the early Levites, when the high temple positions were up for the highest bid, churches have been tainted by the state. There have always been and always will be gangster churches mirroring gangster states. Dietrich Bonhoeffer and his feelings about the German church during World War II would be a good witness here. In Shakespeare's Julius Caesar, Cassius says, "And why should Caesar be a tyrant then? Poor man! I know he would not be a wolf, but that he sees the Romans are but sheep." The truth be told, we are not comfortable in this society with the gray areas of life. Reason and its meta-narrative have brought us to a place that appears to be a crossroad. One road leads to truth, life, and justice, the other to destruction. Unfortunately, the roads are marked with a sign that spins freely in the ground at one moment, announcing the road to the right being the road to perdition. Then a change in the wind declares it to be the road to the left. Left or right, it simply makes little difference at this point in our country's history. For nearly 800 years since the signing of the Magna Carta in 1215, our laws have insisted that every single human being is entitled to some kind of judicial process before he or she can be thrown into jail. We have gone back to a pre-Magna Carta medieval system, not a system of laws, but of executive fiats, where the king, or in this case the president, simply declares on any particular day, "I'm going to throw you into jail." And that jail is a small devil's island comprising 45 square miles at Guantanamo Bay. Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, is in fact, at this point in time, an interrogation camp, the kind outlawed after the Nazi Holocaust and the Geneva Convention of 1949. It is an interrogation camp that is totally and flatly illegal. During the 17th century, the English Parliament passed the Habeas Corpus Act to keep political prisoners from being sent to remote islands and never being seen again. This practice is precisely what the Bush regime has revived. George W. Bush, marrying Pontius Pilate, has broken covenant with the law of this land. Covenant is relationship, and relationship presumes personhood. As long as George W. Bush follows the laws of the United States and the Magna Carta, he can be said to occupy the personhood of his life. Yet when George W. Bush breaks that covenant, as he has done by ruling by presidential fiat, then he breaks with relationship with the law of the land. He breaks with relationship with the personhood of his life, and he becomes nothing more than a loose cannon, a man beyond the law. There is a name for this. George W. Bush is, in fact, in sheer opposition to the Constitution of the United States, the Magna Carta, the Bill of Rights, the will of the people, and the kingdom of God, no matter what you perceive that kingdom to be. We can blame it on 9/11. We can blame it on the president. The president can blame it on Osama bin Laden, and the terrorists can blame it on fate. But the fault, dear Brutus, is not in our stars, but in ourselves.